This episode is brought to you by Kiva, a Greenhorns partner and nonprofit that has helped hundreds of farmers raise over $2 million in microloans, all without charging any interest or fees. Find out more at us.kiva.org/greenhorns. Hey everyone, this is David Tatasciore, lead engineer and studio manager of the Heritage Radio Network, and I'm reaching out to ask for your support during our end-of-year fund drive. A contribution in any amount supports our weekly programming and our mission to make the world a more equitable, sustainable, and delicious place. Plus, you'll receive exclusive member benefits like monthly playlists, discounted event tickets, party invitations, and more. So, if you like good food and you love good food radio, throw a little dough our way. Make your gift at heritageradionetwork.org/donate. Happy holidays from all of us here at Heritage Radio Network.
Greenhorns Radio, radio for young farmers by young farmers, and it is almost Christmas, which means it's almost time to think about buying the new Farmer's Almanac. So to celebrate, we have one of our wonderful and esteemed almanac contributors and legend in his own right on many fronts, all the way from New Hampshire, Doran Cox. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Severin. It's great to be here.
It's great to be with you digitally. I wonder if you could just go straight into introducing yourself, your farm, and the many projects that you're a part of.
I don't want to take too much time with that, but sure. I'm a farmer. Our family farm is certified organic. We have about 100 products that we sell from the farm. We're a part of a cooperative with about six other farms that primarily sell almost all the products that we sell are direct marketed to restaurants and to stores directly from the farm. I think we're sending products now to about 85 restaurants. So huge diversity. I've been particularly, I describe myself as an agriculturalist because I've also been quite involved in a lot of agricultural research and in the role of agriculture in our community in general, and have been involved most recently with a lot of the national soil health movements, including the establishment of the Soil Health Institute and the division, USDA Division of Soil Health. And we've been doing some really fun partnerships with a lot of the new soil health work that's going on to develop farmer networks to improve soil-based carbon capture. And another passion of mine is the exchange of agricultural knowledge and facilitating the exchange of both information and inspiration from farmer to farmer, and sort of that direct process developing tools and cultures that help facilitate that that exchange, which I think is one of the most important aspects of democratic, a thriving democratic community.
So people don't really think about New Hampshire as a place for grain. Can you talk about like your kind of landscape vision for how a food sovereign New England does an evaluation of its terrain and what the social and technological processes are that can empower growers in the region?
Yeah, it's
maybe
interesting
you can talk about farmhouse.
Yeah, there's a pardon me, I'm a little under the weather. The group called Food Solutions New England is actually putting together a vision for 50% food sovereignty by 2060, and that's gotten quite a bit of traction across the New England states. New Hampshire, for example, right now produces less than 5% of its own food. And a lot of what we've been involved in doing is looking at not just extrapolating sort of what has historically been done, but looking at what can be done based on our climate and soils, and understanding that a lot of what is produced agriculturally has very little to do with our natural resource base and much more to do with our inherited culture associated with the agriculture that has taken place. So one of the things that we've pioneered in our little area of New Hampshire has been the production of grains and oilseeds, but in a different way, in that we've focused less on, you often think about those kinds of commodity crops as commodity crops, rather than as important pieces of a closed-loop system. So, for example, when we're growing sunflower and creating oil, we're also producing a high-protein meal, which can be fed directly on farm. And so a lot of what we're talking about with the shifting the scale of a lot of what we think of as big agriculture down to the community level or farm level and sharing the technology to make that that possible. So that allows us to really shift our vision as far as what New England can do and what we're able to do as farmers and what we can do as small farm cooperatives. And I think that's what we're seeing right now in dairy as well, but that we get a lot, we do better as farmers when we are able as a community to control more of our means of production. So that tighter supply chain that we've seen with sort of Know Your Farmer sort of idea and what CSAs has started to do, but really extending that to many to the full value sort of food chain rather than just fruits and veggies. So I think there's a lot of promise of that, but as you well know, a lot of the technology that is that's appropriate be scaled for that community and on-farm value-added production and processing and so forth has not been developed to support that scale. So we're a lot of what our farm is involved with, as well as networks of other farms from around the country and around the world, has been to share the technologies that make things like small-scale grain production and oilseed production feasible and profitable.
So let's talk a little bit about what some of those technologies are, and maybe you could talk about Farmer OS. I'm happy to give a little summary if you need a break in your breath of some of the tools that are featured at the top of the FarmHack page and that are compelling to growing numbers of people working together on a digital kind of a partnership in an open source kind of way to improve on the tools and make the potential gains associated with these appropriate tools shared by many, even if they're cooked up by one or two people. Do you want to talk about how you fell into an open source way of working with your biofuel and how that's translated into a way of operating in the world?
Yeah. I was familiar with the idea of open source software and the power of the concept translated to hardware through the introduction early biodiesel production. There was open source evangelist going around the country by the name of Mark Alviart, or Girl Mark. And she was very clear that it was part of the way in which we can more rapidly create tools that we actually want to use ourselves was by sharing the designs, and that by trying to work towards a pattern of protection of that knowledge would really slow down our capacity to create something that's actually useful And it could be decades instead of really years to create something. And so that community, in a matter of really months, I saw, you know, it was months or 6 months or a year, saw incredible breakthroughs of scaling down industrial technology to the home and farm scale or community scale. And that really sort of, that was kind of an aha moment, and said, well, why aren't we doing this with all of our agricultural technology? And it was, in fact, I think a conversation with you, Severin, that, you know, where we started to explore and realize that, oh, this actually is part of our agrarian history, that it's only been in recent years that that agricultural knowledge has been actively, you know, protected with current intellectual property laws. And,
well, let's not even say protected. Let's say enclosed.
Or enclosed, exactly. That is much, much more accurate. So from that moment on, it's been really clear, and we've reaped the benefits from this approach on our farm. I think most of what we do has benefited directly. Most of the decisions we make have been benefited directly by open knowledge sharing from other farmers from around the state, around the region, around the globe. And again, we share our lineage right for that project, right back to the Enlightenment agrarians. But what we're doing right now is actually trying to extend that knowledge sharing process beyond just farmer to farmer, and be able to provide some level of transparency between farmers and our general public. And so the PharmOS software platform is sort of the result of that work. And so that's a unifying sort of farm record keeping system that is useful for managing a lot of the complex, diverse biological systems that we're doing on farm. But also keeps your own farm data secure and owned by the farmer, which is important. But also, and I think this is key, makes that those on-farm observations and those records very easy to share. But that process is controlled by the farmer. And I think that's a really big distinction what we've seen with big data approaches from the large agribusiness companies, which have certainly rubbed a lot of farmers the wrong way by collecting data from farms and not compensating them for it and controlling the data. We also see that there's been a revolution in observation technology that has enabled us to start to understand some of these more complex biological systems and embrace more diversity in our farms and understand that better. So looking deeper into the soils, understanding the soil-plant atmospheric interactions better. And this has a huge impact in our larger sort of farm relationship to the community, because that when we start to quantify that and document that practices that result in better soil health, better water quality, better air quality, and that has a direct value to all of the people who are downstream in the food shed from the farm. So, and we've seen that especially in our water systems and water quality in the Northeast, and so being able to use a program like PharmOS to quantify the environmental services that the farm provides is, I think, a very important piece of valuing what the agricultural producer is doing beyond just providing calories for the plate, and certainly and sending wholesale food onto the truck and off the farm. So I think it's a
so. I just wanted to take the history back even further and tell you something I just learned this week, which is that within the Polynesian trading traditions, there were explicitly patterns, like star-shaped patterns of trade established between islands that were deliberately not kind of always from the same port to the same port, in order to do a better job of sharing genetics.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I thought that was kind of a fun star-shaped story. But
yeah,
let's talk about the world in which you're situating.
I think the genetic...
I have a second point.
What's that?
Which is that the you're talking about valuing ecological services and having adequate documentation in order to be able to demonstrate land repair and land restoration. And I feel like what's implicit in that work is an understanding that this is the value that is being created by the agrarian and by the land manager, and that in a coming economy, that value will be valued. And I wonder if you could kind of extrapolate a little bit about what that might look like. What, you know, will there be a bounty for land repair? Or how do you see that kind of working?
Yeah, well, I mean, and I think the key there is that there is this, as you said, this underlying assumption that land can be repaired by the agrarian, which I think is a really important shift in our cultural understanding of agriculture and a shift back to, again, the agrarian roots rather than an industrial approach, which is basically input-based agriculture. So I think that's what the PharmOS system is about, is knowledge sharing about how to do that best and document it and make results transferable from what we do in New Hampshire to what works in California or Florida or India or Argentina or Australia, that we can find that a lot of, as much as growing zones change, as much as the soil conditions change, there are aspects that are universal, and we may be able to mix and match. And I think your Polynesian example of cross-pollination is central to this, is that we create more robust systems of agriculture when we can get that hybrid vigor, not just of our genetics, but also the genetics of our ideas. And we can move faster if we can transmit those systems, those ideas of how to make a bag, how to capture carbon, abundant carbon from the atmosphere, and put it into the soil where it's productive and can create the positive feedback loop of land restoration, of, you know, increased water
capacity. Well, looking forward in this policy climate that we're entering with all the environmental organizations that I'm listening to are screaming about deregulation and privatization, increased drilling, and just kind of unchecked, you know. It's a great time for applied work, let's just say that.
Yeah,
and I'm wondering
that. Yes.
What might happen, and, you know, how, if we're in the New Farmers Almanac, a big part of the project is helping new agrarians situate their work and think out loud together, learning together about the ways that we can deepen and broaden and collaborate more profoundly. I wonder if you could just reflect on your own motivations and some of what you talked about in your essay.
Yeah, so the essay I contributed was called An Agriculturalist's Hippocratic Oath, which was taking the concept that sort of the medical version and translating into agriculturalist terms, and asking the question, if doctors are asked to take this oath of sort of public care, why not other professions, and why not especially the agriculturalists who are responsible for the for so much of the health of the community, and to invest with the oath, the importance that the agriculturalists play in creating that changing economy and changing culture and system.
Sounds like a good plan, especially...
pardon me, I'm going to have to... Just 1 second.
Well, it's an interesting moment because Bayer Crop Science, which started as a drug company and a chemical company, has now purchased Monsanto, which is started as a chemical company and became a seed company. So actually, the Hippocratic Oath makes a lot of sense when such a great percentage of our landscape has now been chemically altered by companies who started in industry and started in pharmaceuticals.
Yes.
It's actually pretty fitting.
Yeah, to bring this back and hold them to public account. I mean, I think that's the point of the oath, is to bring it back and to have it be administered publicly so people can be held account, even if not legally, socially, at some level. And I was shocked when I started to look into it that, you know, people think that it was, oh, just do no harm. But when you look back, that a lot of the elements have much more to do with medical version, have much more to do with treating the system of the people as from a holistic perspective, and being humble with what you know and what you don't know, and that you are contributing to a global knowledge commons and a fellowship of other professionals that are working together to advance our total understanding. And so it seemed also there that there were many, many parallels as far as what seemed to be a need in the next stage of agricultural land regeneration. And I also think that we're seeing a parallel in the healthcare industry to recognize that from a chemical perspective, moving beyond the chemical paradigm, even in human health, and understanding again sort of the meta-organism level of human health that ties right down to the microbial systems from our gut to the soil to the rumen of the cow, et cetera. Those paradigms are more universal, and our care for that living system is again more universal than I think our chemical.
So the whole what Donna Haraway calls the holobiont, or the microbiome,
yeah. Right.
of the sick person, especially as everybody, not everybody, but many people are dealing with immunity
right.
issues, Lyme disease and leaky gut and all sorts of other Crohn's disease, et cetera. These are kind of hard to treat with conventional medicine, and so all sorts of people are going more holistic.
Yeah, and so what we're seeing at the soil health level, which is to me just fascinating, that we've made the transition from being treated as very fringe to even use the term health and soil, to now it having a White House directive a few weeks ago that includes the word soil health. So, I mean, it has really, in just a few years, the concept of living soil has really made a huge cultural sort of, there's been a huge cultural shift in acceptance for that notion. And I think that's just like the idea that land can be, soil can be grown. I think that's another a big cultural shift that enables us to then recognize that this is one of our great commons that we have a joint effort as a, you know, that goes beyond our it's a human effort. Essentially, agriculture is a shared human endeavor, and that the way in which we can express our success is through the improved productivity of our soils, and therefore, if we have that shared endeavor, then why would we not share our best practices and put our efforts to understand those systems and share how those systems work and develop the best tools so that every farmer on earth has access to not just the best knowledge, but then the best tools to make their farms the best. And what I love, I've heard, again, more people talking about this. We had Sally Rocky with the new Foundation for Food and Agriculture Research, who's talking about the importance of pre-competitive space, which is this idea that competition is fine, but what we're talking about here is collaboration on this shared human endeavor. And if we want to achieve the best results, this is a mutual. We're not going to achieve the best results if we have a few people, special people in special places who have isolated knowledge. the goal here is that every farmer, every citizen has access to the most amount of knowledge about these systems that are really the foundation for a regenerative economy rather than an extractive economy.
Well, just to tie it back to Benjamin Franklin, who is, as everyone knows, the editor of the first Old Farmer's Almanac, he was also the discoverer, not the discoverer, but he was the first formal documentarian of the Gulf Stream. And he learned about it because the English ships were slower than the Rhode Island ships in delivering the mail. Over, he was the postmaster general of the colonies, and he went out and asked the whalers, why are the English ships slower? And they said, well, because they ignored our good advice, which we learned from tracking the fish, where we went in and out of this current. And Benjamin Franklin had the whaler draw a picture of the Gulf Stream, which Benjamin Franklin then published.
Well,
for the benefit
he's also
of all.
Well known for advocating for open knowledge exchange, and his Franklin stove was, you know, he made the designs open, didn't try to protect his design or enclose his design, and then the person who refined it, who actually made it work better, was able to use that, and so he got a much better stove much quicker. I feel that what we're doing with the development of the internet has awakened essentially a lot of those enlightenment themes that were hidden through the extractive phase of industrial revolution, that we're just on the edge of being able to understand that, and I think that's part of the reason we look back to a lot of those enlightenment thinkers like Benjamin Franklin.
So, if people are interested to learn about the emergent commons in the minds of people like Dorn and others who are thinking about cultural spaces that are essentially reconstituted commons or the beginnings of commons, emergent commons, places for collaboration on topics that haven't even really moved that far yet along online agricultural. Very big, broad, and strong coalition working. Please do order the almanac, which you can do on the Greenhorns website. Being a contributor to the next one, which we do because it's a lot of work. Any last?
No, I just it's been a real pleasure to be able to talk about this subject with your audience. It's something that I think is very current and relevant given our political shifts, and I hope can be empowering. In terms of democratizing the means of production and developing the tools to be able to exchange that through our own means of communicating through more decentralized approaches of knowledge exchange. So it's been a great pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please Join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.